The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. For those of you who missed the morning, we had a great panel. But now we're going to have another really, really great one. That will focus on whether American courts are creating new concepts in terrorist-related detentions. And the moderator for this panel is Professor Stephen Vladek, who many of us know as our professor.
And regret.
I wasn't going to say that in public. Professor Vladek graduated from law school from Yale Law School, where he served as the executive editor of the Yale Law Journal and is the student director of the Balancing Civil Liberties and National Security Post 9/11 Litigation Project, which challenged the executive power with the terrorist-related detainees at Gitmo, including work on the Hamdan case. He also earned his BA from Amherst College, summa cum laude, where he wrote a senior thesis on Leipzig's shadow, the war crimes trials of the First World War and the Second World War and their implications from Nuremberg to the present. And he has served on a variety of legal teams and assisted in various ways on amicus briefs on various cases arising from the War on Terror. He clerked the Honorable Marsh S. Burzon of the Court of Appeals to the Ninth Circuit and the Honorable Rosemary Barquette on the 11th Circuit. And he is a regular contributor to Prof's blog and the National Security Advisors blog. So, Mr. Vladek.
Okay. Hello. Welcome back. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to moderate the second panel of our conference today. The panel is Are American Courts Creating New Concepts to Govern Terrorist-Related Detentions? Let me just briefly tell you what the format will be, and then I will introduce our three very distinguished speakers. The speakers are each going to give short opening remarks, probably somewhere between 5 and 7 minutes, after which I'm going to invoke the moderator's privilege to ask them questions and try to get them to fight with each other, or at least to fight with me, after which we will hopefully have time for your questions as well. Let me introduce our speakers today in the order in which they'll be going. First up and seated in the middle is Mr. David Rifkin. David is a partner at Baker Hostetler. He's a graduate of Columbia Law School, Georgetown University. I guess they don't have the Soviet Affairs degree anymore, but David is a lawyer with a distinguished government service. He worked in both the Reagan and Bush 41 administrations, including a stint as the Associate General Counsel of the Department of Energy and in the office of then Vice President George H.W. Bush. He is a prolific writer and author, and he frequently appears on editorial pages near you. To his left is our second speaker, David Loffman. Mr. Loffman is a partner with the law firm Kelly & Dry, where his practice specializes in white-collar crime and investigations. Before he was at Kelly & Dry, he was an assistant United States attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, where his many credits include successfully prosecuting the Abu Ali case, his work in which earned him the prestigious John Marshall Award for Outstanding Legal Achievement in Litigation from the Justice Department, and he actually also had a brief stint as an intelligence analyst before going crazy and deciding that law was a better profession. And finally, seated all the way on the end, it is always a pleasure to get to introduce people who you're actually friends with outside of the law world. So Justin Florence is an associate at O'Melveny & Myers, a 2006 graduate of Yale Law School, where he held the distinguished time-honored tradition of being the executive editor of the Yale Law Journal. He clerked for the Honorable Diana Gribben Motz on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, and then was one of the inaugural fellows of Georgetown University's Institute for National Security and the Law, Center for National Security and the Law.
It changes every week, so
same here. So those are our panels, and with that, it's my pleasure to introduce David Rifkin.
Thank you, Stephen. It probably was a mistake to put me in the middle, but it's always the first time. Not much time, and let me just run through and give you my sense of what the courts have done. The common assumption, of course, is that it's the Bush administration that has used September 11 as a way to augment in unprecedented and unconstitutional ways executive power. I would argue that most, if not all, empire building since September 11 had occurred in the courts, particularly in the Supreme Court. And that's true with respect, certainly, to the most controversial, at least for lawyers, issue we're talking about today, which is the detention of captured al-Qaeda and Taliban operatives in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Then Mohammed Atta and his compatriots boarded their scheduled flights On September 11, the rights of wartime detainees were governed by a handful of major precedents that were governed by judicial restraint, marked by judicial restraint, especially in regard to foreign nationals held outside the United States. And taken together, these cases, and about four of them, stood to the proposition that captured enemy combatants could be detained in presence of authority without a civilian trial so long as hostilities continued, that terrorists and other unlawful combatants could be tried and punished by military commissions, and that foreign nationals held outside of a territory of the United States were not entitled to challenge their detention in the federal courts. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what a difference a few short years make. The court began slowly with the Hamdi and Rasool decisions that employed some harsh anti-executive branch rhetoric but did not appear to have much of operational significance. For those of us who are at least inclined to be optimistic, like myself, even the Hamdan decision could be construed as more of a technical challenge to the administration's first-generation military commissions, with the two political branches retaining the ultimate ability to proceed largely as they saw fit. Well, all those hopeful expectations were pretty much swept aside in Boumediene, where the court ruled that detainees at Guantanamo Bay and potentially at any other site controlled by the United States were constitutionally entitled to challenge their detention by seeking a writ of habeas corpus in federal courts. Not much time to talk about Boumediene in my original remarks, but let me just say that if you read the decision carefully, there are a couple of things that clearly drove the court. One is it was somewhat erroneous and a historic notion that the current conflict is of unprecedented nature. And together, I would argue, pretty unbridled institutional ambition. And to quote Justice Kennedy briefly, the cases before us, like any precise historical parallel, they involve individuals detained by executive order for duration of a conflict that is already among the longest wars in American history. Well, of course, ladies and gentlemen, laws of war were developed over a period of time and conflicts much, much longer, measuring in decades sometimes, than took place as compared to the ones we've been experiencing in this war. And there's also no question that the rules were meant to be harsh to unlawful combatants because the rules were meant to delegitimize them. In any case, the Congress, of course, before the Boumediene case got to court, acted to ameliorate those harsh rules in 2005 DTA and 2006 Military Commissions Act and created an unprecedented level of access to the courts for enemy combatants. But that was not good enough. But again, what I'm trying to leave with you mostly is not just bemoaning the specific results in Boumediene, but looking at it as, again, as an enormously significant marker as to the future extent of judicial supervision in this area. And I cannot do any better than quote, again, Justice Kennedy, who wrote that because our nation's past military conflicts have been of limited duration, it has been possible to leave outer boundaries of war powers undefined. If some fear terrorism continues to pose dangerous threats to us for years to come, the court might not have this luxury. The result is not inevitable, however. Political branches consistent with their independent obligations to interpret and uphold the Constitution can engage in a genuine debate about how best to preserve constitutional values while protecting the nation from terrorism. Well, needless to say, the Constitution, not the Supreme Court, defines the outer boundaries of war powers, and President Congress, in fact, has been engaged in precisely this debate, how to balance values and public safety, and that was not good enough for the court. So let me just summarize. In my opinion, over the course of a few short years, the court has systematically eviscerated a well-established body of precedent governing the handling of captured enemy combatants. I know it's strong language, but I would put it to you this way. They didn't have intellectual honesty or integrity to acknowledge that they eviscerated a body of precedent and engaged in a kind of Jesuitical hair-splitting that is frankly embarrassing to read. It has ignored the Constitution that clearly assigns judiciary a very limited role in the handling of military affairs and allocates primary powers to the two political branches. What's ironic to me, I don't even think it was necessarily benefited captured enemy combatants. What it really done, it benefited the court as an institution to assign and arrogate to itself a great deal of power. But the only thing I can say in court's defense is that they've done it having spent the previous 40 years amassing an unprecedented amount of power in a domestic sphere and placed itself in control of many areas of domestic policy. And let me defend them one more time and say, in my opinion, the court wouldn't have dared to do this if in the aftermath of September 11, it did not encounter express encouragement by a large chunk of our political and academic establishment. And I hate to sound partisan here, but most of the Democrat Party leaders in the House and the Senate not just acknowledged that the court should go there, but literally begged the court to overturn key provisions of DTA and MCA, and that's a very sad record. I'll just add one point. There are some observers, including my good friend Ben, who is sitting here, who argue that the administration has brought about the state of affairs in some part in itself by proceeding far too long unilaterally on detention-related issues by being too partisan. I don't doubt the administration has made its share of mistakes, but respectfully, I disagree with you. The notion to me that had the administration gotten the DTA-MCA exercise underway a couple of years earlier, things would have been different, is plausible but not likely. The sweeping nature of Boumediene's language, the disingenuous even of Hamdan's statutory analysis, and its willful misconstruction, in my view, of Geneva Conventions, as well as the escalating positions and demands of administration critics, who began by claiming all we wanted was a little bit more intramilitary administrative process, ended up seeking pretty much a wholesale displacement of a traditional laws of war paradigm in favor of a criminal justice paradigm, all lead me to conclude, sadly, that there's probably what happened was inevitable. Not a good thing, Bo. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. My focus, in contrast to what Mr. Rifkin just talked about, is the criminal justice system as opposed to what's happening in the military commissions. And before and after September 11th, the courts have confronted detention issues in three contexts: pretrial detention after a defendant has been arrested, arrest and detentions under the material witness statute, and detention under immigration authorities. And the news is that the courts are utilizing existing authorities in making decisions about detention involving alleged terrorism. And with some exceptions, the courts have been pretty accommodating to the government. I'm going to briefly tell you about these three different authorities the courts have used and give you a few examples of how they have been used. And you'll be talking about this in your criminal procedure courses. The pretrial detention statute, 18 U.S.C. 3142, is used across the board in courts today and has been for years and years. It permits detention if, after a hearing, typically before a magistrate judge, probable cause is found that no condition or combination of conditions will reasonably assure the appearance of the defendant as required and the safety of any other person and the community. The federal rules of evidence do not apply at detention hearings. That means the government can basically throw everything before the magistrate judge to detain a defendant. Hearsay comes in. Intelligence information could come in. It's basically everything the prosecutors can conjure in the effort to obtain detention. And by statute, the magistrates have to take into account a variety of factors, the nature and circumstances of the offense, including by statute whether the offense is a terrorism offense, the weight of the evidence against the defendant, the history and characteristics of the defendant, the nature and seriousness of danger to any person or the community. All those factors are taken into account in ordinary criminal cases, and they're also taken into account in terrorism cases. Moreover, the government has an additional advantage in detention in terrorism cases, and that is, by statute, a rebuttable presumption in favor of detention if there's probable cause that the defendant committed a federal crime of terrorism. And that term federal crime of terrorism takes in a broad swath of offenses, some of which you're familiar with: harboring terrorists, material support to terrorists, financing of terrorism, acts of terrorism transcending national boundaries. Practically every major federal terrorism offense comes within that definition. So magistrate judges have to get around that rebuttable presumption. There have been a number of cases where judges have imposed pretrial detention. Only some of them involve reported decisions, but some of them include what became known as the Virginia Jihad case here in the Eastern District of Virginia, which I helped to prosecute. Although in that case, interestingly, the magistrate judge denied pretrial detention, notwithstanding the fact that there is a rebuttable presumption. So let it be said that judges are not rubber stamps for the government. Some of those cases went up directly to Judge Brinkema, and the magistrate judge's decisions were overturned, and detention was imposed. In the Abu Ali case, which I prosecuted, detention was ordered, even though in a dramatic flare at his initial appearance, Abu Ali stood up, claimed that he'd been tortured, and offered to take his shirt off. To boot, the court imposed what are known as special administrative measures, which are additional measures that restrict the access the defendant has in pretrial detention to outside media or contact, with the exception of lawyers. And we've seen pretrial detention ordered in a number of other cases that have gotten the headlines. The Fort Dix, New Jersey case involving six individuals who were planning to kill U.S. soldiers there. It was used years ago in the embassy bombings case. Wadi al-Hajj spent months and months, 15 months, just on perjury charges in pretrial detention, and another plus 15 months before trial. So courts are very comfortable using the pretrial detention statute in terrorism cases, just as they are in ordinary criminal cases, and they've been pretty accommodating to the government. The material witness statute has been somewhat more controversial. It authorizes an arrest warrant if the government files an affidavit establishing probable cause that the testimony of the defendant is material in a criminal proceeding and that it may become impracticable to secure that testimony by subpoena. There's no express time limit in the material warrant and material witness statute for how long the government can hold a defendant, according to the Second Circuit in the Awadallah case. Now, after 9/11, the Department of Justice used the material witness warrant statute aggressively to detain and thereby neutralize individuals it had concerns about but did not have sufficient evidence to sustain criminal charges. Most of these cases are not reported. If you were to do a Westlaw search of material witness warrants, you would not see very many. But here are some of the ones you would see that reflect favorably and negatively on the government. Some of you may remember a case involving an Egyptian named Al-Higazi. This is a guy who had the misfortune of staying at the Millennium Hotel right across from the World Trade Center on September 11th. He leaves, and in the room safe, they find a radio transceiver. The government believes he was using this transceiver to be in communication with the hijackers. They arrest him. They detain him under the material witness warrant statute. He's held for 34 days until the pilot shows up to whom the radio actually belonged and said, oh, that was my radio. It's been used in other major newsworthy cases, the Padilla case. Padilla was arrested on a material witness warrant and held before he was put in the criminal justice system. He was held for a month before he was declared an enemy combatant. If you go back before 9/11 into domestic terrorism cases, you'll see the use of the material witness warrant statute. Terry Nichols in the Oklahoma City bombing was detained in a material witness case. So it is used. It is used frequently. My sense is that the department is utilizing it less in this era post 9/11 because of some of the criticism it sustained after its aggressive use in 9/11. The material witness warrant received its biggest test in the Awadallah case at the district court level. Judge Scheinlin held that the term criminal proceeding, because individuals can only be held in connection with testimony in a criminal proceeding, she held that that did not include a grand jury proceeding. The Second Circuit pretty much slapped her down, ruled that it did. There really wasn't an issue in that case about how long the individual could be held, but that was the biggest test of the material witness warrant statute to date. Immigration detention. This was a mighty club for the Department of Justice after 9/11. Under 8 U.S.C. 1226A, on a warrant issued by the Attorney General of the United States, an alien may be arrested and detained pending a decision on whether the alien is to be removed from the United States. And detention is mandatory under statute if the alien is reasonably believed to have engaged in terrorist activity. The AG has almost unfettered authority, not subject to judicial review, in these instances. Typically, the government has about 90 days in order to effect an alien's removal. Now, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the Department of Justice heavily relied on immigration authorities to detain aliens believed to be involved in terrorism activity because of the breadth of this authority. Hundreds of individuals were arrested and held practically without restraint. The only curbing of that authority, and it really was a modest curbing of the authority, was in the Supreme Court decision in Zadvydas, where they construed the detention of aliens awaiting deportation to limit the detention to the time reasonably necessary to secure the alien's removal, with 6 months as a purported limit. But the court made clear that its ruling was not applicable necessarily to terrorism cases, and that really hasn't been tested since. I mentioned before that courts are not rubber stamps for the government. We have the rebuttable presumption. There have been other cases where pretrial release has been ordered, including some other terrorism cases. I could find only one case, and then I'll sit down, where anything approaching an expansion of existing authority could be construed. And that is in a very interesting Ninth Circuit decision that just came out a few months ago, which United States versus HIR, H-I-R. It involved a conspiracy to provide material support to terrorists in violation of 18 U.S.C. 2339A. And in that case, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the district court's reversal of a magistrate on the grounds that the danger to the community under the pretrial detention statute can include danger to a foreign community. Typically, the context in which magistrate judges decide detention is whether there's a danger to the community corresponding to the jurisdiction to which the case exists. In this case, if I recall, the danger had to do with the danger to the Philippines, where the gravamen of the terrorist planning existed. So in this case, the Ninth Circuit expanded the authority of magistrate judges to find danger to the community in terrorism cases if the government's evidence indicates that the defendant poses a threat to a foreign country, which is often the case where evidence here is lacking. And with that, I'll sit down. Thanks.
Thank you all for having me here today. I'm glad to be here to talk about these very interesting and important issues. And before I sort of move on to the substance of what I want to say, I just want to make a little legal disclaimer, which is, I don't know if Steve mentioned, but I've been involved in representing two Guantanamo detainees, Messrs. Hamdan and Cotter. And so I just want to make clear that nothing that I'm saying here today should be seen as representing or supporting those clients. And I also, since I'm fairly new at a law firm here in town, just want to say that I am not speaking on behalf of the institution that I am affiliated with, but just on behalf of myself. So pay attention to those two of those words I mentioned as I move forward, affiliated with and supporting, because it turns out that they're pretty important words in this whole area of the law. So I want to focus on one aspect of the question that our panel is addressed to: are courts creating new concepts? And that's particularly the enemy combatant question. And I'd like to focus a little bit on sort of the 1L concept of the difference between procedure and substance in these cases. And my sense is that almost all of the sort of public debate, most of what at least David Rivkin talked about, has related to procedural issues in these cases. So the Supreme Court's cases, Boumediene, Rasool, Hamdi to a good degree, all considered what sorts of procedural rules were in place for courts to review decisions by the executive to detain people as enemy combatants. So is there habeas jurisdiction at all in these cases? What's the territorial scope of that habeas jurisdiction? Under the Due Process Clause, what sorts of procedural rights do people who are classified as enemy combatants by the government have in rebutting that charge? And these are all important questions, and they're necessary issues to deal with, because if the courts say that there is no jurisdiction or that people have absolutely no procedural rights, they can't move on beyond there. But I think what the most interesting issue is, and it's the one that has started to come up a little bit in the courts and is going to be the big deal moving forward over the next few rounds of litigation, is what the substantive rules governing enemy combatant detentions are. And the real question there is, what does it mean to be an enemy combatant? Who is an enemy? Who can we detain in the war on terror? What exactly is it that an individual has to have thought or have done or have thought to have been done by the administration in order to make that person eligible for detention as an enemy combatant? And the reason that this substantive standard is so important, and I think more important than the procedural rules in terms of Miranda rights and confrontation and things like that, is that the category of who an enemy combatant is could be defined so broadly such that it doesn't matter what procedural rights you have to challenge, one has to challenge that designation, you're not going to be able to. So, for example, if our substantive rule for what an enemy combatant was something like an individual can be detained as an enemy combatant if she has ever been part of or supporting or affiliated with any group or organization that in any way harms the war efforts of the United States. That's going to reach a very broad swath of people, probably many people in this room, many members of the U.S. military who have, in their roles, represented detainees at Guantanamo, many members of government, as David Rifkin said, probably many members of Congress, members of this own administration, perhaps. And so no matter, you know, if that were our rule, no matter what sorts of Miranda rights people could claim or what sort of evidentiary standard were involved, you're going to end up reaching just a huge swath of people and have sort of a runaway definition and a runaway detention problem. And that definition that I gave is a little different than the definition of enemy combatant that the administration currently uses, but it's not that different. And the reason is that the administration's definition includes some very vague terms, terms like part of or supporting, terms like Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated groups. And it's very difficult for almost everybody to know what exactly those terms mean, what they entail, what they encompass. And these are the questions that the courts are starting to grapple with. And just to mention one case really in particular, the D.C. Circuit earlier this year, for the first time, reviewed one of the enemy combatant determinations at Guantanamo through the statutory authority that it had through the Detainee Treatment Act. So this wasn't a habeas case. It was a jurisdiction that Congress had explicitly given the circuit to look over the Guantanamo determinations and check, do those Guantanamo determinations meet the Constitution or meet sort of our idea of what an enemy combatant should be, but just do they even meet what the administration says an enemy combatant is? This is the Parhat case. And what the D.C. Circuit there said in a panel with two conservative Republican-appointed judges, this is not sort of the runaway liberal Democratic courts, said that this guy just simply didn't match up to the standard of an enemy combatant. He's a Chinese Uyghur who is part of a group that the group, according to the government, has some sort of connections at some point with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. This man himself was never alleged to have anything to do with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, never alleged to have been involved on a battlefield that the U.S. was on, never alleged to have been part of hostilities with the U.S. in any way. And what the D.C. Circuit said is, this guy, you know, you can call him an enemy combatant all you want, he's just not an enemy combatant. And that is the type of decision that I think courts are going to be looking into, the type of question that courts are going to be looking into more and more, and that's what the really hard question is. It's, what is an enemy combatant, who can we detain, and there are all sorts of legal issues that go into that. Some is what has Congress said about it. So Congress has never explicitly defined what sorts of detention authority the president has. The AUMF, which is the statute that the administration argues and courts have said authorizes detention, doesn't explicitly say who can be detained. The two other statutes that come up a lot here, the DTA and the MCA, neither of them really explicitly grants a detention power. The Patriot Act actually has a little bit to say about detention, but not in the enemy combatant context. And there's actually some legislation pending on the Hill right now. It's a bill that, at least in the Senate, Senators Lieberman and Graham have introduced that would give the president some fairly broad detention authority, including these terms like part of or supporting or associated forces. But it's really going to be significant how Congress wants to handle this. So there's a statutory element, and then there's a constitutional element to this question of who can be an enemy combatant. And that is something that really is going to be left to the courts to figure out. They're starting to, in some places, the Fourth Circuit had an opinion in the Al-Mari case on bank earlier this year in which...
An opinion or nine.
Nine different opinions, or I think it was seven opinions from nine judges, in which many of the judges, including Judge Wilkinson, who is a stalwart of the conservative bench, really got into what sorts of constraints the Constitution puts on who can be an enemy combatant. So I think that is the key new concept that courts are going to have to deal with. Thank you.
So I'm gonna get to my own questions for the panelists in a minute. But first, because I made him go first, I want to offer David Rifkin in particular, and David Laufman, if he wants it, a chance to just reflect on what came after.
Sure. If I may briefly, I think it's actually a discussion that Justin had underscores what a mess we're in. Now, to state the obvious, if a process did not get warped to the point where the courts can have a probing examination of these issues, we would not have substantive problems. Well, we wouldn't be dealing with the substantive issues. I don't want to characterize as problems, Justin. I may disagree. But let me just very briefly mention a couple of things to you. First, ladies and gentlemen, most of the positions that are ascribed to the Bush administration, correctly and incorrectly, are not developed. Fortunately, unfortunately, by Bush, Ashcroft, Gonzalez, Mukasey, or even Vice President Cheney. The concept of who and what does it take to be an enemy combatant has developed in customary law of war for a long, long time. And there clearly, it is not an infinitely flexible concept. Clearly, you know, the proverbial Swiss grandmother sending some money to an Islamist charity is not a combatant. But equally clearly, it is a broad and flexible definition. And providing being a member of, being a part of, being associated with, sort of applying common agency terms, with an enemy combatant organization does make you an enemy combatant. That's how it's always been, ladies and gentlemen. And by the way, the business about associated entities, if you look at the history of warfare, enemy coalitions ebbed and flowed and morphed, so you can begin a war against one set of players and then somebody drops out because that party is defeated or sues for peace and others come in. There's absolutely nothing unusual about that, and there's nothing sinister about it. And yes, you know, sometimes it produces harsh results, but you just cannot possibly have a tighter definition. But here we are. We are talking about tighter definitions. The consequences of having tighter definitions is that, particularly in an environment where you're not dealing with a conventional military, you're dealing with institutions and entities that are very amorphous, that don't keep good membership lists, lots and lots and lots of, and don't have formal hierarchy and ranks and insignia, lots and lots and lots of people are going to slip through their cracks in not particularly advantageous way. And the last thing I will say about Parhat, which I'm quite familiar, Justin is right, it's really not ascribable to Boumediene because the decision really is not driven by Boumediene criteria. It is a review that the D.C. Circuit engaged in the statutory theory. Uyghurs are a bad example, of course. Tough cases make bad law. But I would just posit to you that it is enormously difficult to have really good, robust returns by the government, which would you'd have in a habeas case, in a situation where very able defense lawyers are going to clamor for full discovery. How would you like to wage a war where, you know, you have somebody whose attention is being challenged, and it's not that you have a paucity of evidence, which you may well have because of the battlefield conditions, but if you don't have paucity of evidence, ironclad evidence, but this person is the third assistant of a second guy of this particular cell, and you want to put it in your return, and run the risk that that would come out because, of course, if return is sufficient, the burden shifts, and very able defense counsel are going to seek discovery. That is a hell of a pickle, which is why marrying the substance of a process where things were never litigated like this. Thank you.
I just wanted to comment briefly on how the enemy combatant legal turmoil can impact on the criminal justice system. Mr. Rifkin commented on 40 years of enemy combatant jurisprudence prior to this array of cases that you've been hearing about today. Had we begun the Abu Ali case only with that 40 years to work with, I predict Abu Ali would have been designated an enemy combatant. But because the pendulum had begun to swing against the administration in the Supreme Court, that the decision of whether to go criminal in that case hung in the balance and ultimately just tipped onto the criminal side by early 2005. And so it's a result of that uncertainty that close calls have to be made in the criminal justice system about which way to go. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I'm going to assert my own moderator's privilege and ask a few questions of the panelists in the hope that we can get some kind of exchange going. And I thought where I would jump in is on the question of what Justin raised, right, the substantive detention authority question. David Rifkin, I think, has a very persuasive argument that there is an inherent detention authority within the laws of war. Our charge on this panel is to ask whether the courts are creating new models for detention. And I guess the question is, if the law of war provides a standalone authority, if the law of war provides a normative baseline, is it that the courts are providing a new model, or is it the courts are asking the question of whether the detention authority the government is claiming is consistent with the laws of war? Because that strikes me as less of a creating a new model than asking a question. Right, so if the question is whether the detention of someone like Parhat comports with the laws of war, or whether, if not, Congress and or the President have the authority to deviate from the laws of war. I'm not sure. I guess I'm struggling to see how, in that context, it is the courts who are creating a new model as opposed to the courts applying the traditional standards.
Well, just to take a brief whack at it, and as some of you might have surmised, I'm not a big fan of a recent jurisprudence. Stephen's question would be even more interesting if we didn't have a fairly eclectic or what I call disheveled jurisprudence, because we're in an environment where Supreme Court and a number of other courts simultaneously are engaging in creative reinterpretation of what the customary and treaty-based related laws of war norms provide, and on the other hand are entertaining departures from this. In some sense, it doesn't particularly matter which way they're slicing it. But I mean, I can tell you that there's enormously, if you step away from sort of American jurisprudence, if you look at jurisprudence of various military commissions, courts marshals, and various other bodies over the course of the last 200 years, there's lots and lots and lots of cases dealing with parameters of what does it mean to be an enemy combatant, in large part, actually not in the detention context, interestingly enough, because by and large it wasn't interesting. You were detained, period, whichever kind of combatant you were. But if you were an unlawful combatant, you had no combatant privilege. So there are lots and lots of interesting writings about it, and it's fair to say that there are enormous deference towards battlefield commanders. What we are now moving towards, very briefly, ladies and gentlemen, is a very counterintuitive trend. We have the courts and a lot of critics driving towards an exceedingly narrow definition of enemy combatant, such that particularly in the environment of unlawful combatancy, where again, no rank, no insignia, no membership roles, no payrolls, lots and lots of people are going to slip through the cracks, which is a total disjunction, pathology, if you will, between the rules and the broader goal they're supposed to serve. And, you know, so be it from an evidentiary perspective about how much proof do you need, be it, and by the way, even in a conventional military, remember, you didn't have to be on the, you know, tip of a spear. Cooks, telegraph operators, lorry drivers, you know, lots and lots of people who are functioning in the context of a military organization were all treated as combatants upon capture because they all contributed to war efforts. Again, there's a dividing line, but I mean, in any military, the ratio, what we call tip to tail ratio, is quite high. So the notion these days is if you're not the one, you know, throwing grenades and firing AK-47, you're not a combatant is frankly silly and doesn't comport with lots and lots and lots of centuries of military reality, and again, very, very bad for us.
So let me sort of jump in and ask a follow-up question, because I can't resist. So my follow-up question is, we've been speaking about how some of the problems, some of the what has taken so long has been what Justin referred to as procedural questions. Can you think of a case where a court since 9/11 has refused to allow the government to hold somebody who under the laws of war they're allowed to hold?
Excellent question, Stephen, and my answer is stay tuned because we're just getting there. Look, it's interesting, though, because I grant this, you know, I accord respect to the claims of sincerity and good faith to the critics, and I heard very able lawyers get up before the justices and talk with pain in their voice about how their clients have been detained for 4, 5, 6 years. But remember, we're talking about, by the standards of evolution of the law, a sprint, not a marathon. So the court, again, as I said, began with Rousseau and Hamdi and sprinted very quickly towards Boumediene. We now have lots and lots and lots of cases going on in the footprint of a D.C. circuit, with at least, they try to get them centralized, but it's not going to work, with 3 or 4 justices, and my prediction is by this time next year, we're going to have lots and lots of answers by various able district court judges about what it takes to be an enemy combatant. And there would be decisions that would result in the release. But even more insidiously, I am told by people I know and trust, and then the Korea people, that there is a number of detainees against whom good returns can be filed, but would not be filed. They would be dumbed down returns, running the risk that the government would not carry their prima facie case because there had been no resolution, and for a variety of reasons, and again, they're representing their clients zealously, defense counsel do not want to resolve discovery issues up front. So you have, you know, almost 100 justice and intelligence community lawyers working on that stuff, trying to have a Hobbesian choice. Do you release a bad guy implicitly, or even before you get, you know, to court, just shove the person out? Or do you run the risk of submitting a less than perfect return, in which case I don't need to explain to you how habeas process works? Or do you put everything you can on the return? You get your prima facie case, and then you have discovery issues. That is so it hasn't happened yet. But believe me, it's very close to happening.
So just to sort of push back a little bit on the question of whether courts are venturing off on their own into uncharted territory as a supremacist branch of government, one thing that I think has been interesting about this whole array of cases is the U.S. holds tens of thousands of people in Afghanistan and Iraq as sort of security detainees of some variety. Some we call enemy combatants, some we don't officially give that label. But these are sort of slightly more traditional armed conflicts, slightly more traditional battlefields, and there are really tens of thousands of people there being held by the U.S., probably some of them on pretty shoddy evidence and pretty shaky grounds. None of those cases have really gone anywhere in the U.S. courts, with the one slight exception of the Munaf case, which was American citizens being held in Iraq. And even there, on the merits, the Supreme Court said, sure, you're American citizens, we'll listen to your case, but then decided not to get involved. And so the only cases where the courts are really getting involved are Guantanamo and people who were captured or detained in the United States or American citizens. And I think these are all new ground. They are all types of situations that require a little bit of evolution or departure or rearrangement of what the laws of war are. And the question then is if we need to take the laws of war in a new direction, is that something that the executive branch by itself, with little congressional involvement, with no oversight or review from the courts at all, should be able to choose how that happens? And I think the answer to that is no. I think there is a value to having multiple institutions of government involved. I think if Congress were a little bit more engaged on this substantive question of who can be detained and also by what procedures, the courts might be more deferential. But in cases where Congress hasn't done that, the Al-Mari case is one, I think the courts feel that they have a responsibility to play a role in how this new law develops.
Can I just push back to the pushback with all due respect? I wish you were right, Justin. I wish you were right. We shall see a few years from now. But I can tell you this much, and I wrote a fairly depressing sounding piece in the Wall Street Journal following Boumediene, where I predicted that once Guantanamo is emptied, and Guantanamo would be emptied within the next few years, no matter who wins. There would be more and more challenges with regard to people, because under the logic of Boumediene, right, I'm paying the majority decision too much respect to talk about its logic, but it certainly is if you look at the three factors relating to what is the basis for triggering the court's constitutionally derived jurisdiction, getting Guantanamo specific, we have as much control in Kambuka or Bagram as we have in Guantanamo and many, many other places in the world. By and large, wherever U.S. military fights, it does tend to have control. It tends to have forward operating bases. It tends to have minefields. It tends to have pretty good local security. So, and there would be challenges, and some challenges have been filed already. And I can tell you, my prediction is the way we're going, the United States will be the first remaining military power in this world that, by and large, would not be able to hold for a protracted period of time anybody it captures on a foreign battlefield. And basically, and I'm repeating what I said in that Wall Street Journal article, we basically would be doing two things. we capture people, and we are, to some, we have pretty good, you know, forensic evidence. We have, you know, CSI Kandahar, and we're going to basically try them by military commission, because I think military commissions are going to survive. Grabbed everybody else, we're going to either let them go, or we're going to have the locals take them. But the United States would be basically out of the business of holding enemy combatants for months and years because of litigation risk. And that is a hell of a pickle. I wish I was wrong. I'm much rather you were right, Justin, but I don't think that is the view, by the way, of a number of people, lawyers and non-lawyers in the U.S. military. So I don't want to say that this is just some, you know, nightmare dream that I have seen.
But, you know, Justin referred to the Mudoff case, and I should, while we're doing full disclosure, I should disclose that I was co-counsel on an amicus brief in Mudoff, and so I have my own views. But the Mudoff case strikes me as a very interesting point in your discussion, because in Mudoff, the court says we have jurisdiction to hear these cases, but you lose on the merits. And indeed, they do so in a way that actually suggests that every single person in American custody in Iraq is bound to lose on the merits if they bring a claim like those brought by Mudoff and Omar, because surely similarly situated non-citizens would have no greater legal protections in an American court than similarly situated U.S. citizens. So my question is, aren't we again conflating the jurisdictional question with the substantive question? I mean, right, because you mentioned capturing people on a foreign battlefield. It strikes me that we need to be careful to distinguish between those who are actually captured in a zone of active combat operations and those who are captured elsewhere, not because the laws of war couldn't ever apply to the latter category, but because there's at least more of a question in the latter category about whether they are someone who falls within that regime.
And let me just give you one more thing to respond to along those lines, which is that I think one of the things that's interesting about the cases that have percolated farther up in the judicial system, both the Guantanamo cases and the cases here, it's not so much just where Guantanamo happens to be located or who controls it, it's that where the people who are at Guantanamo are coming from. So you've got the Parhat, who's a Chinese Uyghur, Boumediene, who's was in Bosnia or Algeria, that these are people who have been brought to Gitmo not from necessarily an active zone of combat or battlefield. And so my instinct is that if the administration had never created a Gitmo, obviously this is 40-40 hindsight, and hadn't brought people to Gitmo or brought people to U.S. Military detention facilities, that you would not necessarily have this judicial, procedural, or substantive involvement in those cases.
I was asking this question. Please.
No, not to be unkind to my fellow lawyers, but let me just say how remarkably, I used to be a defense analyst probably almost as many years I've been a lawyer. The notion that courts are better configured institutionally, knowledge-wise, or my temperament to understand what is an active combat zone than the military commanders is just crazy. If you look at history of warfare, you had many conflicts of regional and global nature. We had active combat here, semi-active combat there, periodic resumption of combat here. The notion that, you know, if you were a Wehrmacht officer who got captured somewhere in Spain, Marbella, that you would not be held as a POW, and the reason of a POW because you're a lawful enemy combatant because there's no active fighting in Marbella is insane. That's not what laws of war provide for. So this whole notion to me that, you know, we brought a bunch of cats and dogs together because they were not all from zone of war has no basis in the laws of war. But more importantly, I'm not as familiar probably as you are with Parhat and with Mudoff and Omar cases, but I can tell you, I read the briefs, I listened to their arguments. These are outliers. We're talking about two people, first of all, whose guilt, as far as those things go, and by the way, legal fiction is that merit issues should not impact this, but let's get beyond that. Of course they do, and if you listen to their argument, you understood that the justices were quite comfortable with what they heard about. We're talking about two people, U.S. citizens to be sure, naturalized, who were in the process of being turned over to the judicial system of a country in which they were captured. For the court to have any beef with that notion would have been, shall we say, even more remarkable when this court is prepared, the majority is prepared to go. These cases, to me, say absolutely nothing about the ability of the U.S. military to detain for years to come a bunch of bad guys in a place, you know, in a place in Iraq
or Afghanistan. Absolutely nothing. These are outliers, and I bet you the Obama justices and the Boumediene majority just loved voting for in the way they did in Omar Luna because it shows that they're still tough on terrorism.
Let me just add one fact.
These were, by the way, one last thing I said. These are kind of cases that you would prosecute in this context because they're cases of two terrorists, and one was terrorist, and one was terrorist slash criminal, and that's how the court looked at it.
Although I think we should be careful. I mean, so Omar, there has actually never been a request from the Iraqi government for him to be turned over, and in Munaf's case, his conviction was thrown out because there was no evidence. So, I mean, I agree with your point, which is that these are probably bad guys. But these are all, most of these, I'm not one of those who thinks that, the government is out to get you and they're going to pick up their political enemies and put them in Guantanamo. I mean, I think that's hysteria, right? But I guess the question is, how do we ensure, I'm not saying that if you're not on the battlefield, you can't be held pursuant to the laws of war. I'm just saying it strikes me that there's a greater risk if you're picked up not on a traditional battlefield, whether it's the military defining it or the courts defining it, that you may actually not be subject to the laws of war.
Sold, but the only thing I would say, it would be a delightful world if we're waging a war where our enemies operated in a traditional, lawful manner, observing all the laws and customs on the traditional battlefield. But life would be a lot easier.
We have to go back to Agincourt.
Right. Well, World War II would be okay for me. But the sad reality is that's not how enemies choose to engage us. So it does us no good as lawyers to say, well, in this world, what is a reasonable doubt or in case of doubt for purposes of Article 5 of Geneva III would have been very easy. That's not the war we're waging. The question is, what is the legal paradigm? What are the rules that are consonant with battlefield realities and security challenges we face? And for the first time in human history, ladies and gentlemen, we have rules that are utterly dysfunctional in that they make it difficult for law-abiding democratic body politics to prosecute this war while enormously benefiting the bad guys, writ large, whether or not a given person may or may not be a bad guy. But they have dysfunctional impact. Am I wrong?
I mean,
helpful to us?
I think procedural protections that benefit the bad guys are inevitable. Because that's the point of procedure, is even the most important procedural protections are for the worst people. But that's just my own. But I suspect you and I are going to agree to disagree on.
Again, not a monopolized discussion. We agree that it's the question of balancing, of course, any rule of procedure. To me, the question is how do you balance individual rights and public safety?
And who should balance it?
And who should balance them, but also. And to me, you balance them totally differently in the context of war and peacetime, which is why laws of war, let's be honest about it, are harsh. They have always been much harsher than the civilian rules because there's such a bigger threat. Because if you let a rapist and a mugger and a bank robber go, it's bad, but it's just one guy. And the society and the state is so much more powerful. They ain't the case here.
I've been, in my duties as moderator, I've been neglecting one of our panelists who I think is better comfortable speaking about slightly related topics. So I'm going to move the conversation a bit. And there will be a show that you can buy tickets to where David Rickman and I will spar with each other later. My question, I guess, first for David Loffman, but for I think all of our panelists, goes also to the question of the relationship between the criminal justice and military justice systems. Whatever one may think about the merits of military detention in the war on terrorism, it is certainly true that there is an interaction between the military and civilian criminal justice systems today that there has not been traditionally in the past during prior wars, where you saw some individuals subjected to military process on similar criteria to which others were subjected to criminal prosecution. And so my question for David Loffman is whether he thinks this is perilous in some respects, right? That some have suggested that the ability of the government to go back and forth between two systems actually creates a huge coercive element in the government's favor. I'm wondering if you agree with that criticism, and if not, if you see other problems with the dual nature of the system.
Well, we start from the premise, I think incontrovertible, that what we want most fundamentally, everybody, both sides of this ideological divide, is to protect our fellow citizens from harm from mass casualties, harm from catastrophic acts of terrorism. If the commission system, the tribunal system, the enemy combatant system were less fraught with the turmoil it is, we wouldn't be facing some of the problems we're facing now. Where we are now with respect to Guantanamo is what happens to those individuals, those bad guys, to use Steve's phrase, who cannot be held any longer as a matter of law, or because the intelligence evidence against them cannot pass muster. What happens to them? Do they go back into the pool of potential jihadists who plot another day against the United States? Is there recourse in the criminal justice system of the United States to adjudicate those cases? And it's very difficult to go down the criminal road once you have put those people in the military system, in particular because of the detainee interrogation techniques that have been used. The FBI has worked for years to scrub a number of the Guantanamo cases with an eye towards seeing what cases could be essentially rescued for the criminal justice system. And I think they've come up with bupkis, because there just is not enough there for the government to use, enough evidence that is admissible in an Article III court, enough evidence that Article III judge would find is untainted to withstand scrutiny constitutionally. Once you have opened the Pandora's box, for example, of coercive interrogation, practically everything that comes out of that detainee's mouth thereafter, no matter how well treated he is probably going to be excluded in suppression hearings in an Article III court. Intelligence information that may be used in a commission trial probably is not going to withstand scrutiny in an Article III court. So it is very difficult to proceed from the military venue to the civilian venue, particularly if there have been coercive interrogation techniques used.
I guess just to follow up, so does that, I mean, to your mind, does that bolster the argument that the criminal justice system isn't necessarily well suited for these cases, or is the problem coming earlier that the government should just decide at the outset which paradigm it wants to use?
I think it's more critical for the government to make an informed judgment as soon as possible about which method to use. It's a tough decision. The Abu Ali case was on the bubble, and I suspect there have been other cases on the bubble. But one of the crucibles the government has to resolve is whether to permit, more often than it does currently, the use of intelligence information to declassify it, to scrub it, to create substitution summaries under the Classified Information Procedures Act that can be used in court. The problem is that no court, to my knowledge thus far, has permitted the use of intelligence information offensively in a criminal prosecution the way it can be used defensively by means of discovery to the defense. We haven't reached that point. Another problem is that the government has been loath to permit soldiers, defense officials, intelligence officials to testify in criminal proceedings. DOD in particular has drawn a line in the sand. I can think of one case, I won't say where it's percolating, where there was an act of violence perpetrated against a U.S. government person overseas, but the government would not provide live witnesses who could have provided firsthand evidence against that individual to make the criminal case. So there is a kind of schizophrenia sometimes within the government about how and whether to go forward.
I just make one additional point, which to me shows you how perceptions, common perceptions, namely that the civilian justice is due process laden and kind, legitimate, and military system is the justice, what military music is the music, is wrong, because there are some interesting asymmetries here. For example, look at John Walker Lynn, had a good defense team, you know, fought hard, pled guilty, got, what, 22 years, that's the American Taliban. Look at Mr. Hamdan, and, you know, I certainly didn't represent him, and I don't want to go out of my way to characterize him as the worst of the worst of the bad guy, but he clearly done more than John Walker Lynn did. And yet, if you look at the number of years Mr. Lynn is going to rot in federal penitentiary versus the kind of sentence that Mr. Hamdan gotten, it's an amazing comparison. And the reason for it, actually, in my opinion, military justice system, and I guess my underlying point is, we ought to give it its due and let it operate in its proper sphere. Military justice system is both harsh, and yet it's also very kind, because by and large, military officers sitting as jury can make a distinction between a pretty pathetic-looking combatant who is not, you know, a ranger and a CO and a real threat, like Mr. Hamdan, and somebody much worse. And I suspect if Mr. Lin may have not gotten as much due process, but he wouldn't have been doing 22 years in prison if he came before military commission. And by the way, if you care about Mr. Lin, if I'm Mr. Lin, I know where I would prefer to be. And that's and if you look at some of the material support cases, you know, we got them jury trials, and some of the Virginia Jihad guys who basically didn't do much more, but ran around and you know, played paintball in the old Jihad, are doing what, 8, 10, 12 years. And some of the clear junior al-Qaeda and Taliban members, when they come before military commissions, may get more than Mr. Hamdan. There was some prosecutorial mistakes, in my opinion. Get 2 or 3 years. So you tell me, does it make you feel like military system is such a bad thing? If you consider that?
The problem, of course, with the Hamdan example is that the administration has stated that it, no, even once Hamdan's sentence has run, can continue to hold him as long as it wants. So it kind of creates this situation of heads you win, tails, or heads you lose, you know, tails, the government wins, whatever the president would make of that one.
Let me predict that he will be released in relatively short order once he
passes. But I do think there's something to be said that the military commissions do have a strong value above and beyond what the mere enemy combatant detentions have, and that I think it's not a coincidence that once you get somebody in a commission and the government has to make a case before a judge where the defendant or the person can be present, can call witnesses, can be represented by counsel, and you have a panel of non-partisan or non-interested military officers as the jury in the case, that you do get a slightly different result than you might under the pure CSRT detention system, where in the CSRTs themselves, you know, you're not represented, you don't by counsel, you don't necessarily get to present your own evidence or see the evidence used against you. So,
not to put you on the spot, Justin, it sounds to me that you like military commissions, and how do you explain that every major human rights organization, even in Aftermath, the Hamdan decision, where everybody saw how fair of a judge and jury were, continues to vilify military commissions as if it's somehow a demonic institution that can never do anything right?
Well, I mean, I'm going to jump in because I have my own sort of view on this. I mean, I think I'm going to sound like a broken record. I think we have to be careful to separate out the substantive questions from the jurisdictional questions. I can't speak for every human rights organization under the sun. I can speak for myself. And at least to me, what concerns me the most about the military jurisdictions as currently structured is their jurisdiction, is a personal jurisdiction that to my mind exceeds that which the law of war authorizes, a subject matter jurisdiction that includes offenses that at least a plurality of the Supreme Court has said are not recognized as war crimes by the laws of war. So we can fight over the procedural and evidentiary questions, and I think they are very serious, and I agree with you that the most serious problem in all of these cases is the government's inability to use evidence that would convince any panel, any jury, anywhere in the world, right? But I think we have to be careful to separate out the core of the military commission, right? Trying offenders who are triable by the laws of war for offenses recognized by the laws of war pursuant to procedures consistent with the laws of war, which I have no problem with and which I would gladly criticize any human rights organization for attacking, from what the Military Commissions Act is.
I agree with you, but let me pretend that I'm a law professor, but I'm not, and say this. Would you feel entitled to criticize Article III courts as stridently, if not viciously, when they applied the Alien and Sedition Act, which clearly was unconstitutional?
Sure.
Well, but no, but I would. We probably would not have challenged the integrity of our Article III courts as institutions in the same way. We probably said, have a problem with Alien and Sedition Act, have a problem with this statute.
But
the critics don't make that distinction.
At least Congress at the time sure challenged the integrity of the courts. They tried to impeach Justice Chase. I mean, I think
they failed.
They failed, but I mean, you know, but I think we have, I think reasonable people are going to disagree about most of these really, really hard questions. The key is to separate out the questions and not let them conflate into each other in a way that makes them, you know, meat for the media, but no real fun for debate. I mean, I think the flaw with the military commissions, from my perspective, is structural because of their jurisdiction, not structural because of the premise, right, that you can have military courts to try offenders in this new kind of war. I think that is not the problem. And I think that's not what every single critic of the military commission says. The problem is that you can't use that as the basis for adopting a view of military jurisdiction far more expansive than any we've seen previously. Right? That's the
And along these lines, in terms of what Steve was saying of separating out these questions and these different issues, on what I open with, the substantive question of who can you detain, when you look at the civilian criminal law that gets applied in Article III courts, there's actually extraordinarily broad criminal liability, the material support statutes that came up, the conspiracy statutes. You can use those, and the government successfully has used those. The Padilla case is but one example, to catch people who do have these sort of fairly loose affiliations to some sort of broader global jihad and who haven't necessarily committed some particular overt act. So the point is not that there's all these bad people out there who we shouldn't be able to lock up. It's just, can we do it in a process where we call them enemy combatants, where we don't give them a lawyer, where we don't allow a court to review their claims, where we don't sort of look at the evidence that's involved or give them a chance to put on some sort of defense or story for explaining, oh, yeah, sure, I talked to that person, but I didn't know that he was an Al-Qaeda person when I talked to him, or, yeah, sure, I gave money to that orphanage in Afghanistan, and I didn't know that money was going to Al-Qaeda. And, you know, this Afghan orphanage and the little old lady in Switzerland, the reason that comes up, a government lawyer actually said in oral argument in a district court in Washington that person, this is the little old lady in Switzerland who sends a check to the orphanage that ends up in Al-Qaeda's hands, that person would meet the definition for an enemy combatant.
He said a stupid thing.
To our knowledge,
he may not have been speaking for the government's policy, but it's the prospect, right? I mean, that's the. I'm sorry, David.
I just wanted to. There's also a segment of criticism of the government's anti-terrorism policy since 9/11 in some quarters that holds that the government has failed if only that which it has proved, I'm talking about Article III courts, is some offense less than a terrorism offense, not material support. Maybe it's a tax fraud, maybe it's Social Security fraud, labor certification fraud, immigration fraud. Who cares? The point is to take people off the street who are bad actors, who present national security threats to our fellow citizens or to U.S. citizens abroad. The government took the same approach during the heyday of organized crime when Al Capone was defying authorities, and what was Al Capone convicted of? Tax fraud. He wasn't convicted of murder, but he was put away for the rest of his life. I have no problem as a former terrorism prosecutor satisfying myself that we're putting people away if the evidence is there and the rule of law is observed for offenses that don't sound in terrorism, if they are neutralized for some period of time, at which point they no longer present a threat to the United States.
I have one more very, very short question, and then I'm going to throw it open to members of the audience. You guys have been very patient. Thank you. My very, very short question is a prediction question. Justin briefly mentioned the Al-Mara case. I'm curious if the panelists have any views on whether they think the Supreme Court has more to say in the next year or two on the issues we've been talking about in this panel, whether you think it's likely they will take these cases, and what you hope they say if you got to play Justice Kennedy for a day.
Well, I'll start with that, and I'm going to, even though Steve asked if he could ask me about this earlier, I'm sort of going to dodge it just because I clerked for one of the judges on the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit when that case was decided. But what I'm going to say is that I think what's going to be more significant than how or whether the Supreme Court grants cert in these cases or what it says about them is the approach that the new administration, whichever it is, takes to how it wants to handle these. And it'll be interesting to see when there is a changeover within the Justice Department what sorts of legal positions both the Office of Legal Counsel takes, the Solicitor General takes before the Supreme Court, and whoever the new president is. I wouldn't be surprised if there are some noticeable alterations from some of the positions that the Bush administration has taken to date, and so that may, you know, moot or in some other way eliminate the possibility that the Supreme Court ends up getting involved in some of these, at least.
Well, let's hope there's a calming down period. Bad policy makes bad law. If this administration had not taken such an unduly aggressive position, We wouldn't be in the state we're in with respect to the jurisprudence we've been discussed. But when you're talking about detaining people, even bad people, for eternity, you're putting yourself at risk before the Supreme Court. That's the position the administration has taken in these cases. I would hope, as Justin says, the new administration does take a fresh look at its policy. Guantanamo will begin to winnow down, but there will have to be alternatives to Guantanamo. And by the way, we can't send all these people back to their countries of origin. Some of them have asylum claims. Some of them may have convention against torture claims. Once you put these people in places like Guantanamo, you may be stuck with them for a long time.
I guess I don't have much hard support on this panel. I do not want to defend the administration except to point out, if you were in it for you, given half an hour's lot instead of five, I had a very beautiful discussion about how the world looked from a perspective of Eisentrager and Quirin and Yamashita. Nothing this administration has put forward in the first and second and third wave litigation was not, and unlike FISA, unlike debates about torture on detention issues, didn't have to go to first principles, okay? If you look at the Milligan and Reed Milligan together with Yamashita and Quirin and Eisentrager, this is an area that the courts have plowed through. You just were following the case law. Having said that, that's all over, it doesn't matter. I think the only bad case that the court is likely to take unless it's vitiated is, and I talked about it with my good friend Ben Whitties earlier in the day, is the Hamdi appeal. If that is mooted somehow, I think Almari is virtually cert-proof. You got to have a full stomach and several hours to read for seven opinions. And even then, I mean, you really need, it's like playing three-dimensional chess to figure out how it all works.
And they all apologize for being long. Right. They're like, I'm sorry this is a 70-page opinion, but we're really smart, and this is really hard.
Right. And we have really good clerks.
And really good clerks.
But what's going to happen inevitably, no matter who wins, is the mess that begins in the district court level with multiple lines of habeas petitions. And by the way, I'm glad Dave mentioned it. I mean, it's a mess. We have some people whom we would love to send back. We cannot send back because we cannot adequate assurances about torture. And what the heck are we supposed to, and there's no third country to take them. And yes, I remember what the court said, it was obvious, but I wouldn't hold my breath. So we have some people, and one of the things that any next administration have to wrestle with this, do we really want to give asylum to people and let them walk the streets? We cannot send them back, and we cannot keep them in detention anymore. It's a hell of a pickle.
We have some time for questions. I would just ask questioners to please come to the microphones that are in the aisles and try to keep your questions to questions.
That's all the stuff.
Sir.
The short answer, and there's not much time. It's a fair question, but I would say my read, and I'm not a huge fan of a triptych, but my read at least of this situation, too obtuse myself, the Youngstown Justice Jackson's typology for how you parse the interaction between the presidential and other constitutional powers. Is there you had a very clear statute that limited president's power to proceed the way the president proceeded. Here we have an authority to detain people in the context of warfare, sir, but as long as warfare itself. You cannot possibly, and let's leave aside the question of what it takes to unleash the dogs of war. But once the dogs of war have been unleashed, either by an attack by our enemies or AUMF or some combination thereof, the notion that the president does not have a power to detain captured enemy combatants in a situation where international law of war requires him to give quarter, which is, again, a fancy way of saying you have to accept surrender, he just shoot people who have been rendered harmless. The notion that that does not exist without express congressional regulation and the emergence of a narrow civil detention regime, the Patriot Act, somehow supplants it in the same way the statute in Youngstown did, to me, it's not a very strong argument. But my problem with Judge Motz is not even that, is the notion that you somehow miraculously cannot be a combatant unless you fight on behalf of a sovereign state, which is utterly, sorry to say, incoherent as a matter of laws of war, utterly at variance with precedent, doesn't even goes beyond what, you know, most European NGOs have ever said. So under her logic, if you're not fighting on behalf of a sovereign state, people from Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, would never be a combatant. He would always be a criminal, but no more than that. That is just plain silly.
That's not a question of detention regime. It's a question of classification.
Although, to be fair, right, I mean, I guess the part of the problem is one might make the argument that during World War II there was no separate detention statute that says the government is authorized to detain German prisoners of war, right? So I think I agree with the question. I think the heart of the question is where does whatever detention authority is contained within the AUMF, right, the authorization for use of military force.
But you're being very fair. Off. What I love about this exchange is it underscores again that it ain't just about duration. Under Judge Watts's logic, again, you can be Osama bin Laden. It's not a question of whether you're being detained for 45 years or 45 months. It's just that there's no such thing as detention.
Well, to be fair to Judge Motz,
I have the opinion very carefully. Did I get it wrong? Can you be a quote a combatant if you're not affiliated with a sovereign state?
I took.
Well,
wait, but the.
But. These are apples and oranges. I do statutory parsing for a living. Here you have AUMF. It is an authorization to use military force doing one thing in its sphere. Here you have a Patriot Act that authorizes very carefully delineated criminal justice type detention regime.
It's not criminal justice detention.
Well, terrorism detention regime. Pray tell.
Can you find one thing in the legislative history of the AUMF
no.
that shows that any member of Congress thought it gave
No, I cannot find any such thing, but that to me is not dispositive. If you look at, I could do no better than tell you to reread Plurality Opinion by Justice O'Connor, who is hardly a partisan of executive power, who points out how AUMF overrides Non-Detention Act. Okay?
I prefer to read Justice Scalia's opinion,
who's
not exactly
a partisan. I suspect we have an insurmountable difference of opinion here, but it does beg the larger question, right, which is the mandatory detention provision of the USA Patriot Act, in cases of U.S. citizens, the Non-Detention Act, right, have been read as requiring more of a clear statement, at the very least, from Congress before you detain at least those individuals with what we might think of as full constitutional protection. So U.S. citizens anywhere and non-citizens lawfully within the United States.
But wait a minute. Hamdi involved a U.S. citizen.
Picked up on the battlefield.
Picked up on a battlefield. This is a classical, if you're grading somebody's law exam and you're parsing what are the material facts? The court indeed mentioned on a battlefield. But did the court suggest in Hamdi but the question of what is a battlefield is something uniquely fit for judicial resolution.
Well, I would point out that Justice Breyer, who is the critical fourth vote in favor of the plurality opinion in Hamdi, joins in a footnote the same day in Padilla that says where it's a U.S. citizen picked up within the domestic United States, I would not read the AUMF as authorizing detention. So we may read it differently, but at least he who was the key swing vote, I never would have thought Justice Breyer would be the critical swing vote, but he who was the key swing vote in Hamdi certainly thought that was the critical dispositive distinction.
And the phrase apples and oranges, which you used earlier, actually echoes something that Judge Wilkinson said in an earlier decision where he was comparing Hamdi to Padilla. This was before Padilla made its way to the Fourth Circuit when it was still up in New York in the Second Circuit. And Judge Wilkinson said, comparing Hamdi, who was on the battlefield with his Kalashnikov rifle, you know, engaged in combat with the U.S., comparing him to Padilla, who's picked up in O'Hare Airport, who's a U.S. citizen, is like comparing apples to oranges.
Yes,
and so,
let me just say, I agree with you, but don't you think there are a lot of things in between? Hamdi was a very convenient example, one bookend, and Padilla, who disembarked at O'Hare and was picked up as
FBI. Very,
by the FBI and held him, is another bookend. But what if? How would you feel, just out of curiosity, even what you're right about, how would you feel if we actually picked up a bona fide Al-Qaeda member who slipped into this country and is captured in a hotel room in Florida with a bunch of bomb-making equipment, having been dispatched here to launch an attack? Would you feel that there is enough of an indicia of active battlefield to treat this person? And let's assume he carries a membership card which says, I was, you know...
Is he a U.S. citizen?
Yeah.
Prosecuted for treason.
No, but I'm not asking what other options. Would you feel comfortable treating, would you feel comfortable treating this person as an enemy combatant?
But let me put it this way. I would feel comfortable treating him as an enemy combatant if I could be more convinced that Congress actually meant for the detention authority and the AUMF to include the domestic detention of United States citizens. I think Congress has the power to so provide.
Right.
But
so
I
it's,
think,
not a constitu- it's not a due process issue. It is a separation of powers issue.
I'm willing to say that I actually prefer Souter's approach to Scalia's. I actually think there is a constitutional authority to preventively detain a U.S. citizen. But, man, Congress better be specific.
And I think that's where the due process concern comes in, is when there is no specific statute describing what it is to be an enemy combatant, at least for people who are in the U.S. or who are U.S. citizens, that you get some of these, you know, more difficult questions about somebody who once talked to somebody or somebody who has something on his laptop or somebody who
used credit. So you don't believe in federal common law anymore? Because we do have several cases enriching the body of federal common law. Milligan is a perfect.
No, and Milligan, you know, as the plurality opinion in Alomari goes through, was accused of being, affiliated with an enemy organization here
behind
in the U.S.,
lines,
behind enemy lines
time.
In a time of war, intending to, commit hostilities against the U.S., and the Supreme Court says this person cannot be subjected to military jurisdiction.
But only because the court marched for the facts and concluded, and if I had 5 minutes, I could recite all of them. It's not that the allegation is insufficient. If true, it's that that's not what happened. The guy was a buffoon. The people he affiliated were buffoons. In fact, the regular Southern Spies network shied him because he was a buffoon.
But the buffoon.
I don't remember Justice Davis's opinion saying he's a buffoon.
And the buffoon
can't
question, some of these. And I certainly am not totally well-versed on some of the sort of incidents that the Justice Department or the FBI or the Homeland Security Department have sort of identified in the United States as, you know, breaking news, CNN, the next big terrorist attack, and then you sometimes learn that it is, you know, some buffoons. And it's not to say that buffoons can't be, right, that buffoons can't be dangerous or that our law enforcement shouldn't deal with buffoons, but that it is sometimes a fine line between a buffoon
Milligan,
and Osama bin Laden.
Yeah. Milligan.
Why don't we see if there's one more question before we come
sorry.
Here. I think we have time, if we don't talk as long as we just did, for one more question. Especially if it's on the short side. Chris?
My wife never says that. Because
the focus of the discussion seems to be a lot of actions taking place overseas, or maybe getting one or two people out at O'Hare Airport. How does the calculus change, and also how is the current jurisprudence say, a bombing campaign in New York City, similar to what London experienced in the 70s and 80s from the IRA, just to kind of be more specific on the question, is the jurisprudence that we have now equip us well enough to deal with a domestic bombing campaign from an organization that has U.S. citizens, resident aliens, foreign nationals? And also, just sort of bring the realist perspective, how's that going to change the calculus with what the people are going to demand as far as safety is concerned, what the justice is going to deliver?
Well, I think we are equipped, both from an investigative authority standpoint and from the standpoint of whether these people have been indicted and the courts have authorities available to them to adjudicate those kinds of cases under existing legal authority. FISA is in a state of the law where if there's probable cause that the individual is an agent of a foreign power or post-Musawi, a lone wolf, FISA surveillance can be instituted pursuant to court order by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or failing that, a standard Title III surveillance order can be established. Whether our domestic intelligence authorities are skilled enough and adept enough to intercept the activity is another question. But these cases are pursued all the time. I mean, there are, thank God we have not had another repetition of that kind of activity, but the investigative authorities exist. Conspiracy law is well developed. The law of material support for terrorism is now well developed. The Classified Information Procedures Act provides a very flexible mechanism for Article III judges to preside over the use of intelligence-derived information in court proceedings. Due process protections for defendants are very robust. I think we've seen this demonstrated in a variety of cases.
What?
Well, let's take the immediate aftermath of 9/11 as an example, where we at the Department of Justice had reason to believe that there were other attacks coming down the road. We magnified as aggressively as possible the use of all existing legal mechanisms under the Attorney General's authorities and the President's authorities, using immigration authorities, material witness warrants, stepped up physical and electronic surveillance. And those are all the things that we felt were necessary and appropriate to move as quickly as possible. Now, if we as a society if we experience some kind of cataclysmic disaster, I expect there will be a hue and cry for even more aggressive investigative techniques and maybe an abridgment of some of the kinds of protections that defendants have received in these kinds of cases. But right now, my answer to you would be we are well equipped to handle that kind of scenario.
So your question sort of raises the issue of how we view a domestic threat versus an international threat. Obviously, these can be interlinked, but since I know the next panel is on sort of do we need new institutions or concepts here, and I'm sure this idea of the National Security Court will be much discussed there, I just want to throw out the idea that any discussion of a National Security Court or of some sort of entirely new legal regime for dealing with a terrorist threat should be very thoughtful of the fact that the threats may come from people right here, from the Oklahoma City bombers or crazy guys who go decide to shoot up a college campus or a high school, that those types of people are terrorists in the same way and can be just as dangerous and destructive. And so to the extent that some new institution of law is created, it should be very cognizant about whether we want to bring those people who we sort of very traditionally have handled through the criminal law enforcement process under its auspices.
And for those, if any of you are interested in that question, there's a report that I may or may not have been involved in helping to prepare, put out by the Constitution Project called The Critique of National Security Courts for one view of the issue. There are certainly others. I want to thank the panelists very much for what was an enriching conversation, and thanks to all of you for being such a patient audience.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're taking a 15-minute break before our next panel begins at 2:30.